When you come to the end and look back on your life, what do you think will emerge as being really important?
I think all of us actually would like to aspire to a life of long-term happiness. And if we invest our time, our energy, our resources in things that will be there for us in the long term, our family, our friends, our relationships, our home life, our children, those are the profound payoffs in life. And I think that is the goal of the book, is if you think about your own life, as you, what do you want it to have amounted to at the end of your life, you might have very different answers than if you just think about what's on my calendar tomorrow.
That's Karen Dillon. Writer's Voice's Drew Adamek talks with her about the book she co-authored, How Will You Measure Your Life? And later, we listen to an encore interview with Bruce Frankel. I spoke to him in 2010 about his book, What Should I Do for the Rest of My Life? That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
How Will You Measure Your Life was born out of a series of lectures and seminars held by business school professor Clayton Christensen. Christensen, famed for his innovative and insightful business theories, was a college classmate of Jeffrey Skilling, the Enron president now serving a 24-year prison sentence for fraud, insider trading, and conspiracy. Christensen, a devout Mormon, felt that the usual measures of success, money, promotion, status, failed to adequately measure the quality of one's life and didn't always equal happiness. To help his students avoid Jeffrey Skilling's fate, Christensen set out a business plan of living an ethical life. Christensen's approach stresses family, community, and permanence over profits and selfishness. Applying business theories such as forward planning, resource allocation, and incentives theory, Christensen tried to teach his students to measure their lives and careers by the amount of purpose-driven good that they were able to create instead of the amount of money or status that they earned. The book pairs each theory with examples from the business world, as well as instructions for applying them in one's personal life. However, unlike most self-help books, the authors do not make change sound easy or fast. The book stresses that the hard work and dedication that goes into building a successful business are also required for building a good life. In the last 5 years, Christensen has suffered a heart attack, a stroke, and survived cancer. After his health scares, his lectures took on an added urgency. Together with co-authors Karen Dillon and James Allworth, Christensen laid out his principles in How Will You Measure Your Life? Co-author Karen Dillon is the former editor of the Harvard Business Review. She wrote the first article on Christensen's lectures, a piece that ultimately led to this book. She also took the lessons of How Will You Measure Your Life to heart and quit her high-stress job to focus on raising her children. I spoke to Karen Dillon about how to apply business strategy to one's personal life, the importance of sacrifice, and what's really important in a career. Thank you for joining us, Karen.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tell me, what is the genesis of this book? Every author involved in this book is a sort of a high-powered, very successful person. Why write a book about the development and measurement of values in one's personal life?
Well, the book came out of something that had been happening in Clay Christensen's class at Harvard Business School for years. At the last lecture of every semester, or every class that he taught, Clay basically said to his students, I've taught you all the best business theories I know, so you will have a successful career, and I want you to have a successful career, but I also want you to have a successful life. So I want us together in this room today to think about how do we apply the best thinking we've learned in this class all semester to having a happy and fulfilling life. And it's a wildly popular class. I've been in that classroom before when it's standing room only. People bring their fiancés, their cousins, their friends. It's an important and special graduation moment for his class to say, I want you to make sure that you think about your life. You just don't go out and lead the life that seems easy before you. And the reason that he's done this is because that he was classmates with some famous people who fell from grace, including Jeffrey Skilling of Enron. And he's thought himself a lot over the years about how to make sure his students live better lives than so many of his classmates ended up doing. So the class itself was sort of famous and popular. But at the end of 2010, Clay himself got the kind of cancer that his father had died of. And when he gave that class, it was especially powerful because his students knew he was bald from the chemo, that this was especially important to him. I heard about that when I was the editor of Harvard Business Review from a student, and I simply was looking to turn the sort of magic in that room into a good essay for Harvard Business Review. I called him up and asked him if I could come and we could figure out how to turn it into an essay. Long story short, we did, and it grew from there.
One of the first problems that you approach in the book is the perception of what creates happiness. What are the misconceptions that you approached in the book in the beginning about what is success, what is happiness, what are the measures of a good life?
Well, the answer is different for everybody, but what the book hopefully does is gives you the tools to think about it yourself. The basic idea is that this book is really written towards high achievers, people who naturally are rewarded for many things in their career quickly and along the way, that those people tend to make choices in their careers and in their lives to some extent for the wrong reasons. The quick satisfaction, the quick sign of success from the professional world tends to overshadow everything else, and it's very easy to think that's what will make me happy, when in reality what actually motivates us, what actually will deeply make us happy over time may be very different than the things we're naturally drawn to see as the measures of our success. So the book explores that dichotomy, why we all tend to fall into the same traps of reaching out for the kinds of things that really, truly, if you think about it, are not going to make you happy in the long run.
And the sort of novel approach that the book takes, in my mind, is that you use business theories and principles to lay out a program of fulfillment and integrity. So I want to pose a question from you that you pose in the book, which is how do fundamental business theories relate to finding happiness?
It's an interesting question, and I hope we've explored it satisfactorily in the book. But Clay Christensen is famous for his business theories, which sounds like an academic thing, but in reality, it's a very simple thing. It's really deeply understanding what causes what to happen. And that is the basic underpinning of the book, that happiness is the consequence of actions and choices that we all make.
And that leads me directly into my next question, which is strategy. Will you talk a little bit about the role of strategy in one's life and the two different types of strategy that people and businesses employ?
Strategy, a lot of us think of, is just the goal I want to get to. My strategy in life is to be healthy and happy and successful. You know, you may have your own version of that. But in reality, what we definitely know from years and years of academic work and thinking is that strategy is not the end state. Strategy is something that's formed in everyday actions. And so in reality, what you say is your destination is not your strategy at all. Your strategy is the choices that you make every single day, every minute, every hour, every week, every month of your life about how you're going to spend your own time, your energy, your resources. The same thing is true for a business as it is for a person. So a business's strategy is determined by how it spends its energy, its resources, its money, its uses its staff time. Same thing is true for a person, how you spend your own personal resources. I think if you understand that strategy is not an end state, a goal, but an everyday living, breathing, dynamic thing, that's a piece of knowledge that's really interesting to think about, because if you understand that, then you have to realize how are your everyday actions feeding into your ultimate goal. Am I actually spending my time and energy toward the thing that I say is my strategy? Your strategy is how you spend your own time, and if you understand how those two things fit together, you can be much more conscious of choosing to spend your own personal energy and time on the things that are leading you to the goal that you actually aspire to. The two different kinds of strategies that we explore in the book are both very important in business and in our lives. We call them the two, emergent and deliberate. Emergent is you don't exactly know what's going to happen tomorrow. Opportunities may come your way that you didn't anticipate. You have to seize them when they seem interesting and they seem like good chances to take or good opportunities to take. You can't have planned it. It maybe wasn't in a master five-year plan. But boy, that's too good an opportunity to miss or too good a path not to explore. We all have to be open to those. At the same time, we have to ultimately turn to a deliberate strategy if we are going to achieve our ultimate goals. We can't just let random things bob us along forever at some point when we have a pretty clear idea of where we're going, we have to be very sure what is our deliberate strategy, what are the choices we must make on a certain path to get to where we want to be. And the book, I think, makes the case that your life will be a combination of both of those things, and you have to be open to it. Sometimes there will be emergent opportunities for you that will be very exciting and interesting and take you down paths you least expected. Other times you have to stay very focused on what your goals are and stay on that path, and you have to be prepared to ebb and flow with the two types of strategies.
This is Drew Adamek for Writer's Voice, and I'm talking to Karen Dillon, co-author of How Will You Measure Your Life? The book talks about the difference between incentives and motives and motivation. What are the differences between those two, and how are they applied in people's lives and in business?
It's a very important concept. Incentives, we tend to use those two words, incentive and motivation, very interchangeably in our life. In thinking about jobs or in thinking about if you're a manager or where you want to go in your career, what's going to incentivize me, what's going to motivate me? In reality, those are two very different things, and it matters that they're different because one will keep you going long-term, and one really won't. Incentives are things like, so I can pay you as a manager to want what I want, to do what I want you to do. I'll give you a bonus. I'll give you extra time off. I will achieve the result that I want because I incentivize you, and you'll do it, not because you particularly want to or because you're excited by it or you think it's the right thing. You'll do it because I've asked you to do it with a prize. And at some point, those work for all of us. We all get incentives in our job that do get us going and doing things. But those aren't the reasons that we get out of bed in the morning. Those aren't the reasons that we're excited about our job. Those aren't the reasons we take jobs that will keep us going. Those are things that motivate us. And the kinds of things that motivate us, you typically can't see on a piece of paper. It's not a promotion. It's not a raise. It's not a title. It's whether or not you feel like you've accomplished something in a day. Are you given responsibility? Are you given opportunities to grow? The difference between incentives and motivation is the difference between long-term feelings of success and happiness in your job and short-term. And all of us should be striving to be motivated by our job or in our job rather than incentivized by our job.
And one of the principles in the book that struck me as well was the idea that you can both love and hate your job if you are motivated by it.
Basically, there's a very famous piece of academic work that says there are two different scales of satisfaction. You can be dissatisfied in your job or not dissatisfied. That's one scale. And the other scale is whether you can actually be satisfied. And they're not the same scale. It's not one continuous spectrum. So the kinds of things that could make you dissatisfied or unhappy in your job are when your basic needs are not being met. You're not being paid enough. You can't support your family. You have a bad relationship with your manager. You're not respected. Those can make you very unhappy in a job, and those are just dissatisfaction factors for all of us. There's a minimum of all those things that have to be right for you not to be dissatisfied. But at a certain point, just fixing all of those things doesn't necessarily make you satisfied in your job. They just make you not dissatisfied in your job. What will make you satisfied is respect from your boss, chance to grow, chance to learn, chance to stretch, doing something you think matters in the world. Those kinds of things are not on the same scale as the things that will make you unhappy in your job. And you have to recognize there are two different scales you're working on to get to the point of happiness in a career.
There's also another important theme that runs throughout the book, and that's the idea of resource allocation. How does one use and analyze resource allocation in their life and in their business effectively to create happiness and success?
That's something that struck me very personally when I was working on the book because it was something when I ran my own mind through my own personal resource allocation, I realized I had a problem. But in essence, it goes back to the question of strategy that we mentioned earlier. Strategy is really the result of how a company actually allocates its resources, how it, you know, what it decides is actually important enough on any given day to do first, to put its energy into, to spend its money on, to have its staff work on. And your ultimate strategy is really a huge component of it is your daily resource allocation. The same is true of our lives. So if you actually say, the most important thing in my life to me is my family, okay, probably true for most of us, but if we stop and look at our calendar, for example, look at your calendar over a week, a month, even a year. If that is true, and you look at how you spent your time over the course of that time, does that seem to jump off the pages? Did your family take priority most of the time? Did you actually spend your discretionary and to some extent non-discretionary time with your family? You can very quickly determine if a strategy for a company or a person's personal strategy is really true, is really what they're doing, by actually seeing where the rubber meets the road. Where are they spending their energy, their time, their resources? There's a famous Gloria Steinem quote. I can tell you something like, I can tell you what people's priorities are by looking at their checkbook. I can tell you what people's strategy is by how they allocate their own personal resources. And that was something that I realized myself when I was writing the book. I had a strategy for my life. I thought that my family was most important. And I realized as I was writing this with Clay and thinking about it is, but my family did not get the best part of my time by far. And that was something when I kind of came to that uncomfortable truth, I decided to make some changes in my life to fix that because I did want to be living the strategy that I believed I'd been living for a bunch of years before that. So I think that's, you know, it's not something you can put off for 5 or 10 years. My strategy will work in the long term, but I'm going to ignore my resource allocation question for now. Resource allocation is a daily decision about what matters to you, and that can't be put in abeyance for a long time.
But if one has been engaged in a strategy for a long time and motivated and incentivized for certain things, and life or business has gone off the rails, how does one change really deeply ingrained ideals and behaviors and habits?
Well, that's a hard question, and everyone's going to have a different answer for it. I did a crazy dramatic thing. I quit my job. I was the editor of Harvard Business Review, and I quit with good will on both sides and good wishes, and I became a contributing editor, basically a freelance contributor to Harvard Business Review, specifically so I could spend more time with my family. It was that important to me. I know Clay's sort of famous theory is something called disruptive innovation, which basically says you have to ignore the company that's wildly successful, doesn't ever want to change anything because it doesn't want to give up, you know, what it seems to have gotten right because it doesn't want to lose its valuable customers, but then upstarts come in because they dare to do things completely differently, and they'll end up taking the share of that business. To some extent, I think that's true in life, too. You can't just, if you decide truly in your heart that something's off course and you know what the course is that you want it to be on, you can't sort of tinker at the edges. You have to really make a big choice about, am I spending my time the right way, or whatever your personal thing is, and maybe it takes some brave decisions. You know, maybe not everyone can or should do what I did, but I think we kind of all know in our heart of hearts when we're doing the right thing with our time, when we're in the right place in our job. It may take some years to correct it, but I think if you really sort of deeply ask yourself these questions and come up with better answers for yourself, I think we can really, you know, start by changing the biggest things you can possibly afford to change it in a given time and then keep working at it. But it's a leap of faith. It's a gigantic leap of faith, and you have to really want what you're changing your life to be. You know, you have to really want what you're going to go for, because otherwise it is going to be too hard. There'll be too many incentives that come at you to stick with where you are already.
This is Drew Adamek of Writer's Voice, and I'm talking to Karen Dillon, co-author of How Will You Measure Your Life? Your book extols the virtue of sacrifice in its role in happiness, but we live in such a selfish, self-centered society. Will you talk a little bit about the role of sacrifice and how that factors into one's happiness?
The idea is that, at a simple level, we all value things that we had to sacrifice for or that we chose to sacrifice for. You look at, I would say, as a mom of two kids, I can see my kids' shelves get cluttered with, you know, good sport awards and team participation awards and all the things that they get just because, you know, they were on the soccer team or at the end of the school year. And those things don't seem to matter to them as much as the things that they had to work really hard for or the things that they actually had to give up something in their life for, you know, give up a vacation day to do a charity fundraiser or something like that on a very simple level. But the basic idea is that some of the people who are most inspired in the world and inspiring to us are people who are willing to sacrifice for other people. And I think it feels true if you think about it in your own life. The things that you have sacrificed for, or the times that you've seen people sacrifice on your behalf, those are the things that just are the most powerful. They're worth sacrificing for, and thus we value them. It's just a nice circle. And I think it's like in love, if somebody's worth sacrificing for, then you know, that's a pretty powerful relationship. It matters to you. If someone's not, you have to fundamentally question, is it the right relationship for you? It's very simple, but a very powerful idea. And again, it rings very true to me as well.
Will you talk a little bit about the imbalance that children face these days between skills and experiences?
Again, I don't know if you're a parent of children, but it's very true when you watch your children. We, especially middle-class American parents probably, you know, we all want so much to give our children, you know, every opportunity in life and to give them things maybe that we didn't have. And especially when you have the resources to be able to do that, you want to flood your child with every interest that they have. They need violin lessons and Chinese lessons, and they need to have the best gymnastics coach. And it's because we love them so much that we're trying to give them all of these things. But an idea that is explored in the book is that that's giving your children skills, things that they learn to do because they are taught to do it. That's only a piece of the puzzle of turning your children into capable adults in the long run, or helping them become capable adults. That you need to give them experiences too. It's not just about getting the certain level of distinction in the acting class. It is also about having the experience of having to try out for a play and not getting a part, and having the courage to come back the next time and get a part, or to try out for the play and not get a part, and daring to put your hand up to learn lighting or something like that. That the things that maybe never would go on even a kid resume are actually as valuable or even more valuable because they help your child build character. They learn how to overcome difficult things. They learn, I can do that when something's challenging or doesn't come to them easily. It's about building a kind of personal capability that has nothing to do with anything that would ever look impressive to their peers, but makes them sort of stronger, more resilient human beings.
What are the risks that parents, families, companies face when they outsource, and what are the inherent dangers in outsourcing?
Again, with love, I don't think there are any evil parents out there there may be a few, but I don't know any who genuinely don't want to be with their kids and want to just fob their kids off on other people all the time. We all, with great intentions, sort of put many other people into our children's lives, coaches, babysitters, tutors. Our kids will spend lots of time with other people. And the risk is not that any of those people are bad or evil or will teach your kid evil ways, but it's that you as a parent miss some of the most wonderful teachable moments with your children because you're not there. You may not be there when they strike out at baseball, and you may not be there to say, get back in the pool after they've lost a race or something. There's an opportunity for you as a parent to influence your children's values when you're with them in the moment. And if we are constantly outsourcing our kids' time, again, with no bad intentions, you're just missing probably what are the very informal but very powerful moments with your children for you, the parent, to be putting in place a set of values. You know, in our family, we try again, or in our family, we're always a good sport, or in our family, whatever it is that matters to you, because somebody else is there instead of you in that moment. And that person probably, you know, will be kind to your child but not love your child like you do. It's one of the most precious gifts you can give your children, are values, because they'll carry them for the rest of their life. And if your children are constantly not with you for all kinds of good reasons, you lose that opportunity.
And the danger for a manufacturing company or a computer company or a law firm in outsourcing?
Well, there's a great example in the book of Dell, and I think this is a really powerful one, and you can apply it to lots of other situations. Dell had a supplier called ASUS, if I pronounce it correctly, ASUS, which basically did, in the beginning, the smallest kinds of outsourcing of manufacturing bits and parts for Dell computers. And as Dell started seeing that ASUS was capable of doing it, it made it easier to outsource more and more to ASUS because Dell became more profitable as a result of not having to carry the cost of doing all those things on its own books. And so little by little, ACES would complete the next level of assignment, and then they'd kind of come back, you know, hat in hand saying, well, we did a good job with this. Can we take on this responsibility and this responsibility? And every time, Dell got very excited about, great, one more thing we don't have to worry about, one more thing that will make us more profitable if we take it off of our books and we just outsource it. It seemed like a good idea at the time, seemed like a very good idea at the time. But in what is kind of a Greek tragedy, ACES actually turns out to have all along the way figured out the best way to do what Dell does cheaper, better, faster. And ACES became sort of, you know, like the locust eating up inside the house. ACES took so much of the value of what Dell had given it and turned it into being a powerful competitor of Dell. And without Dell realizing, if they had realized at the first decision to start outsourcing where it was going to lead, they never would have done it. But it just crept up little bit by little bit, termites, I guess, you know, working their way through the house until suddenly it was the point of no return. And Dell had outsourced not only the specifics of the parts and the technology, but some of the knowledge that comes from figuring that out and how things work together and how you manufacture faster and how you put things together and what customer needs are changing. Somehow all of that shifted out of house to ACES, and Dell was left really with just a shell of a computer company that, for the PC market, they really just put their name on products that other people made.
And that gets me ultimately to what I took away from the book, which is the value of long-term thinking based on a purposeful meditation or a meditation on what your purpose is versus a short-term immediate gratification strategy, as it were. Is that an accurate reading of how this book was put together? And the ultimate purpose of the book is to really take a long-term view?
Well, it's definitely one of the ultimate purposes of the book. It's so important. And I think one of the things the book was trying to really spell out for people, particularly with the theory, what causes what things to happen, is that there's so much conspiring against us in life these days, in modern life, to not want us to take a long-term view. Business has an incredibly difficult time taking a long-term view because they have to report quarterly results to Wall Street, who will just shred them for any swings, you know, ups and downs. It's very, very hard in the best of circumstances to genuinely make decisions that are looking out to a long term. Most CEOs won't have a term long enough to actually see the benefit of their actions. They'll be kicked out or retire or move on quickly before the decisions they've made that are truly long-term will ever pay off. It's a very hard thing to do. The same is true in our lives, especially if people are naturally achievers. It's so much easier to get rewarded for something and keep going in that direction. It's so easy to spend an extra half hour at the office every day because you get 10 more things done, or you get 3 emails out that you meant to, or it's quiet now, I'm just going to organize myself for tomorrow. You get a very tangible sense of achievement in the short term, and it feels good. Look at that. Close that book. I finished it. I've done that chapter. Or I've got that report out. Phew, I'm all set. You feel good when that happens. It's kind of a natural high. It's very hard in those moments to be constantly keeping your eye on what does this decision lead me to in the long term, and you can't connect the dots that easily. But the difference, I guess it is the thesis of the book, the difference between leading a life that is aiming towards long-term happiness and leading one that just, you know, it's okay to have short-term happiness, that's enough, is very profound. And I think all of us actually would like to aspire to a life of long-term happiness. And if we invest our time, our energy, our resources in things that will be there for us in the long term, our family, our friends, our relationship, our home life, our children, those are the profound payoffs in life. But it's super hard to keep your eye on that long-term ball when so much is tempting you to just grab at short-term success because it feels good, it feels better in the moment. You can see it, you can talk to your friends about it. But man, you know, those things aren't going to be there for you when you're 65. And it's a really big difference, I think. And I think that is the goal of the book, is if you think about your own life as what do you want it to have amounted to at the end of your life, you might have very different answers than if you just think about what's on my calendar tomorrow.
Thank you so much for joining us, Karen.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Karen Dillon. She spoke with Drew Adamek this week about the book she co-authored, How Will You Measure Your Life? Next up, we listen back to my 2010 interview with Bruce Frankel about his book, what should I do for the rest of my life? Stay tuned after the break. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Bruce Frankl's book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life?, introduces the reader to a host of unforgettable everyday people he interviewed who found fulfillment, happiness, and a measure of success in following their passion after the age of 60. Sometimes the passion wasn't new, just the success, like Harry Bernstein, who finally got a book published at age 94 after writing 40 unpublished novels. Other times, the passion was new, like the former intelligence officer Thomas Dwyer, who became a modern dancer in his mid-50s and continues to dance professionally in his 70s. Or even more surprising, the Orthodox Jewish banker's wife Naomi Wilsig, creator of the World Erotic Art Museum and one of the world's greatest experts on erotic art. Bruce Frankl got the idea for the book when he faced his own professional crossroads in life. He quit his job as reporter for People magazine, he's also worked for USA Today, to become a poet and poetry teacher. That didn't work out so well. So instead, he wrote a wonderful, thoughtful book that shows it's never too late to follow your dream. I spoke with Bruce Frankl in August of 2010. Bruce Frankl, welcome to Writer's Voice. You're a writer, you're a reporter, you've written about other things, not this before you wrote this book. What got you interested in adults who decide to change their lives and do something quite different in the second half of their lives?
Well, actually, my own life really was the door that opened the way to this. I had, as you said, worked as a reporter for most of my life in the last part for USA Today and People magazine. And I left working full-time as a journalist at the age of 51 to fulfill my own passion to go back to school and get an MFA in poetry at Sarah Lawrence College. And when I got done with that program, I had assumed that I would get a job as a teaching poetry and English. And I miscalculated a bit how my life went after that point, and things kind of fell apart in terms of my marriage and my life, and I found myself suddenly needing to find work. And one day I was having lunch with a close friend of mine, another writer, who was turning 60 that week, and he had had a project blow up on him, and he had written several books, but he was also facing questions about what he was going to do to recover his life and how he was going to make a living at age 60 as a writer. Many of us who worked in newspapers and magazines found our world falling away. So we sat over long four glasses of water at a cheap sushi joint. And on my long walk home, I kept turning over ideas, trying to come up with something that the two of us could collaborate on. And by the time I got home, I had this brainstorm that we would write a book together, collaborate on a book about people who achieved significant success after 60, and we would thus become successful. It was somewhat whimsical. My friend Jim was dubious of whether we could find the people, and he eventually got another book to write and did well with it. And I was kind of stuck with my own idea.
Yeah, you say people after 60. You start off your book with somebody who achieved success as a writer at the age of 94. Tell us about him.
Well, that's Harry Bernstein, who I adore. And Harry has actually turned 100 at the end of May. And Harry had worked his entire life as a writer, really. He published his first short stories in the late 1920s. He came from Chicago to New York, but he could never really make a dime at his short stories. They were published in little magazines next to people like Nelson Algren and William Carlos Williams and Gertrude Stein, but he could never make a dime. They were proletarian journals. He ended up working the end of his career as a editor for a construction trade magazine and retired to Brick, New Jersey. He had a great wife named Ruby, who he adored, and they lived in a quiet, comfortable life in a bungalow in New Jersey until Ruby passed away. She was just 90, I believe, or around there. And it was the first time in Harry's life that he had ever lived alone. And in a way to escape his pain, he began to write. First, he wrote a piece for Newsweek magazine that got taken by them. And then he sat down and, to get away from his pain, wrote about his life in England before World War I.
Harry had an incredibly brutal upbringing. Tell us about some of that. Tell us about the experiences that he had to overcome and the resilience that he had.
Well, Harry had phenomenal resilience. I mean, he did, as you said, have brutal childhood. His father was a brutal man who was an alcoholic and brutalized his mother and stole money, and yet his mother could not leave him. And Harry also suffered through the Depression. And when he met Ruby, his life changed, as he says. I mean, he found not just the love of his life, he found a woman who supported him as he wrote novels. He wrote 40 novels that were rejected over time, but he kept writing. He destroyed most of them, sadly. But at any rate, after Ruby passed away and he began writing, he found for the first time his true voice in a way. He started at 95, 94, and the book was first rejected by everyone in the United States, but accepted by Random House in England at 97.
And why do you think he found his voice? What was it about that story?
I think that he learned the lesson that all writers eventually learn, which is write what you know. He had written other things that he thought he knew, but they were imaginative. And when he wrote about the life that he had actually lived and was unafraid to write about the brutality of it and the odd beauty of it, I think that everything flowed naturally, as he would tell you, that he doesn't really work very hard at his writing. He thinks it, he lays in bed and dreams it, and then he gets up and writes it.
And he really seems to be a lesson in tenacity.
He's remarkable. I mean, I went to Harry's birthday party a few weeks ago for his 100th birthday. He had been a little ill before and been in bed for a few weeks at his daughter's house, but he got out and came to the birthday party. He was in a wheelchair, and he had just completed his fourth book in 5 years. And I spoke to him on the phone last week, and he told me he had launched his writing a fifth book now. So
it's phenomenal. Another really phenomenal person, and they all were, actually. All the stories in your book are just, the stories are great. They're well written. I have to congratulate you on that. But the people themselves really make the story also. But I was fascinated with the story of Naomi Wiltick, who is the proprietor, the owner, the manager of, is it the world's?
Erotic.
It's the World Erotic Art Museum. Is it the only one or major one of its kind?
It is. There's now another one, not exactly like it, in Las Vegas. There's an erotic art museum in New York, but it's not very good in comparison. And there's one in Paris. But Naomi's story is marvelous. I mean, she's a great character in many, many ways. She was the one person, and I should say thank you for your kind comments about my writing, but the truth is that you're right. The stories, the people are the story, and I tried to put my writing at the service of the stories, which was easy to do because they were great. But at any rate, Naomi was married to Ziggy Wilczek, who was a Holocaust survivor and an amazingly successful banker in New Jersey. He was a very powerful man. He was a founder, one of the co-founders of the Holocaust Museum in Washington. He was also a very vain man, and he really was the tyrant of the family. And Naomi, at one point, she was always trying to lose weight, because he wanted a perfect woman, a perfect body. And so she was always going off to other diets and spas and so forth. And one day she was at a spa and she came across a magazine that had a listing for a nudist colony in it. And she pursued that. And that was the beginning of Naomi's liberation from her past, from her husband. And the discovery of something that it would eventually lead to the discovery of erotic art.
And she was not a wild and crazy character before this.
No, she wasn't. And as she will quickly tell you, she missed the sexual revolution entirely. She grew up in an Orthodox family where there weren't graven images. She read about the sexual revolution in the newspaper, the magazines was about as close as she ever got to it. And she was a mainstay in her synagogue in New Jersey, and she did not live a roaring life. And I think that Naomi would actually tell you too, even her venture into nudism was really an act of liberation, in which she discovered that a way in which she could exist without being defined by the money that surrounded her, being judged for who she was and what she knew.
Or even how she looked.
And certainly how she looked. I mean, I think she really came to see that people look all kinds of ways, and there are very few perfect bodies in this world, and she didn't have to live in that prison. And I loved her story. At one point, I was wondered whether I would use her story, because I wanted the stories all to reflect the lives of people who had not achieved prior success, who had no great means to acquire success, but who after 60 found their idea and their passion. I decided, despite her wealth, to use Naomi's story, because I felt that she overcame so many hurdles in achieving this. And because, like the other people in the book, what she achieves is not monetary, but it's a vision, and it has a mission attached to it, which in her case, she now speaks to classes on human sexuality. Professors have her all the time. She's made herself into an expert on the subject. And so she's come an awful long way from the childhood and the marriage she had to a person who has a great breadth of knowledge about human sexuality and how it has been represented through the course of human history in art.
And she came to it in a kind of very typical way for a woman of her kind, as a good Yiddish mama?
Absolutely. I mean, Naomi, you know, she was sitting at home one day and she got a phone call from one of her sons, who is a pretty interesting character himself, Sir Ivan. He's a former banker, now rock musician. And he called and asked his mom, knowing that she had started down a life of nudity to some degree, if she would get him some erotic art. But she didn't have any idea what erotic art was. She had to ask him, "What is it? I don't know what it is." And he tried to explain, and it took her more than a year of, she used to antique, she would go to antique stores, and she couldn't get up the nerve to ask if people had erotic art. And finally, she did one day, at the tag end of asking for porcelain or china that she was looking for, she let slip that she was also interested in erotic art. And much to her delight and the dismay of the owner of the store, they actually had a piece which they had secreted away, which became the great lesson for her, as this stuff was all around, but you had to know how to ask and be trusted to ask for it.
It's a wonderful story. And we're talking with Bruce Frankel. His book is What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? True Stories of Finding Success, Passion, and New Meaning in the Second Half of Life. Another story that I found also personally very interesting to me, because my mother is a dancer and choreographer, and her last performance at Lincoln Center was when she was 83 years old. She'll be turning 90 this week. And you talk about a dancer named Thomas Dwyer. And unlike my mother, who actually has been a dancer all her life, he started when he was in his 50s. Tell us about him and how he got into being a dancer. It's really a marvelous tale that you tell there in your book, and you obviously are quite impressed with this man.
Well, I've fallen in love with so many of the people in my book. I have relationships now with all of them there. I admire them greatly and adore them. But Thomas came to me, I learned about Thomas, I should say. I had started a relationship of my own a few years after my marriage fell apart with a woman I had known in my boyhood, and she was a dancer and had been a dancer her entire life. And I said to her one day, there couldn't possibly be a dancer. No one starts dance in late in life. That just doesn't happen, right? And she thought, and she said, no, actually, I know of a couple of possibilities for you. And she put me in touch with the Liz Lerman Dance Exchange, which is in Maryland on the edge of Washington. And there was a dancer there named Thomas Dwyer. And I went down to see Thomas. And Thomas's story is, as you say, quite remarkable. Thomas had been in U.S. intelligence service, probably the CIA, though that will never get confirmed, for his entire life, practically, from his 20s, certainly. He was a telecommunications specialist and often worked in back channels for embassies all over the world, particularly in the Far East. And he had retired in his 50s, come to Washington, didn't know what he was going to do, thought about opening a detective agency, took painting lessons, and then one day saw his elder brother in a elder dance performance and saw the look on kids' faces as they watched and said, this is what I want to do. I want to do this. I want to show young people that you don't have to just sit in a rocking chair. And he began to take dance lessons at the Liz Lerman Dance Exchange or work with classes there. And he had no skill. He had never taken a dance class. He had not been athletic. He was your proverbial 95-pound weakling when he was a kid. His family was shocked when he said, this is what I want to do. He had none of the attributes of a dancer. But he worked at it. And Liz Lerman will tell you that she loves Thomas, particularly because he worked so hard to overcome the physical issues that he had to overcome to become a dancer. And now he still dances.
At the age of?
75, and he's still a principal dancer, and he's got a wonderful presence on stage. He'll never look like a ballet dancer, but that really isn't the point of dance in the Liz Lerman world anyway. But it's, he has, when Thomas comes on stage to dance, everyone's head turns to watch Thomas.
Say some more about Liz Lerman and her project. Tell us what it's called, and it includes both professional and unprofessional dancers.
That's right. Liz Lerman was herself a dancer and choreographer, and many years ago, and she's now a MacArthur fellow, and her mother became ill with cancer about 25 years ago, maybe more. I can't quite remember. After her mother died, she wanted to choreograph a dance about her mother, and she needed elder dancers to do it. And so she began working at a home for elderly, and she saw these people who were just sitting around and not doing anything, and no one thought they could do anything. And she began to work with them and play music and get them to dance. And lo and behold, of course, what has been observed elsewhere since, put music on and people, something sparks in people. They came to life. Many of them learned dance. And she came up with this idea then, I guess really now, it's probably 30 years ago, of creating an intergenerational dance company in which young trained dancers would dance with older dancers, those who were older dancers who had danced in their lives, and those who had never danced before. Because Liz had this notion of the body being able to express somehow more if it's not so refined in its movements. And so they have a very interesting methodology of arriving at the actual dance movements, where they, as they call them, youngin, will do a dance move, and then the elder dancer will do the same move. Now that move, because the body has its own history, will be changed. And then the youngin will reflect that change. And back and forth they go, editing the dance until they have a structure within which they can all work together. And it's quite remarkable. And they tell stories, of course, too.
What was interesting to me, and this is something I also saw in my mother, you know, as she aged. Well, for example, when she was 76, the Village Voice named her as Dance Pick of the Year. Her name is Frances Alenikoff. But nonetheless, at 76, and even more so at 83, which was after her first big fall, when she had broken her leg, you know, her movements were quite different, but she had a different kind of power. And you notice the same thing in Thomas Dwyer.
Yeah, absolutely. Thomas, of course, worked very hard. He was also, when he was younger, was not, as I said, not an athlete. And even in his later years, when he decided that he was going to become a dancer, he began a very strict regimen of training his body physically. And he still does, like 2 hours of warm-up before the day begins. And young dancers, when they see him in workshops in colleges and universities, are agog at what Thomas puts himself through. He can do countless push-ups. And in one of Liz Lerman's dance programs, Genome, which looks at the history of DNA and discovery of it, and Thomas plays the part at one point in the dance of someone who has been genetically programmed so he can't die even though he is aged. And he undertakes to commit suicide by doing so many push-ups. And when they were rehearsing that, they had to stop Thomas because the audience would get too bored. They cut him off at 45 push-ups with his legs up on a chair because he could have gone on forever.
We're talking with Bruce Frankel about people who change their lives after the age of 60, go into new professions, follow new passions, and do so successfully.
One of the things that I think happens when people fasten on an idea late in life is that all of their experience and all of their intelligences pour into that, funnel into that in the service of what they become committed to and passionate about. They've learned skills that you don't learn when you're 20 years old or when you're in school. Ted Levitsik, who is the sculptor in the book, who was a contact lens grinder for most of his life, and then discovered after he had retired from the field of contact lens grinding, one day had built a seawall next to his little property in Havistraw, New York. He had spent a year building this wall, and it looked blank to him, and he, at that moment, he looked down in the water, and there was a stone that he picked up and had this desire to chisel a face on. And he went to his garage and got a hammer and a broken lawnmower blade to use as a chisel and carved a face and plastered it to the wall. And the next day, Ted returned to admire his handiwork. And when he looked at the wall, He thought the face would look joyful, and yet he felt it looked sad because it was alone, and he felt it needed a companion. So off he went in search of another stone, which he carved. And now, you know, almost 20 years later, there are 1,700 heads, and some of the heads are quite large in proportion. The property is called the Easter Island on the Hudson now, and he has evolved into an amazing sculptor over these years. It's collected by numerous museums, in particular the Visionary Museum in Baltimore. But, you know, that's one of those cases in which Ted couldn't have told you that he was going to become a sculptor. He didn't know that that path was ahead of him, and he couldn't have told you that he had the skills, though they were there because he had trained his hands and his sensibilities over time.
For you, you're a baby boomer. You were in your 50s when you started this. As you are going into now these later decades of your life, what was the greatest lesson, personal lesson, of this book and the people that you met through it for you?
Working on this book and coming to know these people utterly changed my life. It changed my sense of timeline. I am 60. I turned 60 on January 2nd. And when I left Time Inc. at the age of 51, I thought my life was closing down in a way at that point. And I didn't really know what was left to do or what possibilities would present themselves to me. And what I learned in interviewing these people and being with them was not to really think about age. They don't think about age. They don't talk about their age. They talk about what they want to do next. They live their lives, as I say, forward. They don't live in regret or rumination about what they could have done, should have done. It just is not part of their mentality. And I think that that really is the key. They focus on what they are doing and what they want to accomplish. And so they're living towards something, always. And, you know, that has been an enormous lesson to me. If things go wrong in my day, I don't sit around and think about what I could have done differently. I think about what I can do next, how I'm going to make the next chapter happen, the next word happen, whatever it is.
Bruce Frankel, your wonderful book and inspiring book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
In addition to What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life?, Bruce Frankel co-authored the New York Times bestseller, World War II, History's Greatest Conflict in Pictures. Before going out on his own as a writer, he was a reporter for USA Today and People magazine. You just heard a long excerpt from my 2010 interview with Bruce Frankel. As you heard, I told Frankel about my own mother, whose last performance on the professional dance stage was at the age of 83. My mother passed away this June at the age of 92. She had a great run, and she was a great inspiration to many. Frances Alenikoff kept dancing her life, even to the end. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.